Sarah, I started a Substack last spring, just kind of as an experiment, and it turns out I love it. I'm treating it kind of like an old school blog, writing about things that are happening in my life.
Megan, I've loved following your stuff on Substack, and I actually just really like Substack in general.
You know, we've both been a lot less active on Instagram lately, and I'm finding that Substack scratches that itch to connect and create without all the busyness of a typical social media feed. So I would love it if Mom Hour listeners wanted to look me up there. I'm at meganfrancis.substack.com, and that's Megan with two A's, meganfrancis.substack.com.
Hi, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Megan.
We're two moms with eight kids between us, from little to grown.
We're in different areas of the country and in different stages of life.
But we both know that motherhood's a lot easier when real moms share tips and encouragement.
And remind you that it's really all going to be okay.
We're not experts. We're parents who've been there.
We're not perfect. We're real. Welcome to the Mom Hour.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to episode 224 of the Mom Hour. I'm Sarah Powers, here as always with Megan Francis. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Sarah, I'm so jealous how you just 224 just rolled off your tongue.
Just rolled off the tongue. I mean, I can just take over that job from now on. We're pretty good at dividing and conquering around here. guys, this is a continuation of last week's episode where we took your listener questions and gave our possibly helpful answers, question mark? Who knows?
I think they were pretty helpful. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say we were great.
Okay. We always enjoy these listener questions episodes, and we really, really, really love getting your questions, in particular the ones where you record your voice and send them in. I think because you guys listen to our voices all the dang time, and yeah, we don't ever get to hear yours. So if you're not clear how to do that, we'll link it up in the show notes. And we always do these about every 3 months. We do it a couple times. So if we haven't gotten to your question or you'd still like to send one in, we're always taking new ones. Megan, the end of the school year and kickoff to summer is a busy time of the year for families, but we can all eat stress-free and hit our wellness goals with ready-to-eat meals from our sponsor, Factor.
Factor's delicious meals are never frozen and can be ready to eat in just 2 minutes. You can pick from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular choices like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Plus, they have more than 60 add-ons like breakfast, lunch, snacks, and beverages to keep you fueled all day long.
So our team was comparing notes recently on our favorite Factor meals, and Katie loved the herb-crusted chicken with mashed cauliflower and toasted almond green beans. I loved that one too. And get this, so did her little boy, Charlie. She heated it up for lunch one day, and Charlie, who's three, ate almost all of the green beans. I mean, that's quite an endorsement, right?
I was going to say, what a parenting win. And I get it, Charlie. Those green beans are crazy good. And if you really want to treat yourself, they even have meals with filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. Listeners, head to factormeals.com/momhour50 and use code MOMHOUR50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code MOMHOUR50 at factormeals.com/momhour50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. We are welcoming back Vionic as a sponsor today. And Sarah, I will be honest. I was sorting through my warmer weather wardrobe the other day, and it could seriously use a refresh. But you know what's good to go? My shoes. I've got a great selection to choose from thanks to the Vionic Vitals collection. And lately, the pair I keep putting on again and again is the Uptown Loafer. I have two pairs, one in sand suede and the other in camel leather, but please don't make me pick a favorite.
Oh, I won't. I'll let you keep both. That's so funny, Megan, because I was a little jealous of your Uptown Loafers. I was the last one on our team to get a pair, but I just did. I also got mine in the sand suede, and I think I've worn them like 4 times this week. They really finish off a cute spring outfit. The Vionic Vitals collection has the best essential styles for everyday wear to get you ready for spring. And no matter what shoes you choose, you'll be on the go in comfort because every single pair of Vionic shoes delivers their trademark VioMotion technology for a difference you can feel. Vionic sandals, sneakers, and flats all offer incredible support, stability, and cushioning, and every pair comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, so it's easy to try them out.
Use code THEMOMHOUR15 at checkout for 15% off your entire order at vionicshoes.com when you log into your account. That's a one-time use only. Vionic shoes. Wearable well-being for your feet.
Okay. So our first question, this is kind of fun because I feel like it's actually continuing a dialogue from an episode a couple weeks ago. If you guys listened, we talked about home management systems. And one of the things we talked about that was working in my house was giving away, donating used items. And as part of that conversation, Megan, you and I both sort of giggled about going around the house, scooping up toys that haven't been played with in a while that we know the kids aren't going to miss, putting them in a black garbage bag and sending them off with the donation people. And you made a comment, something to the effect of, you know, and they never notice, the kids never notice. And here's what's funny. In that moment, we were on the clock, we were recording, we have an outline, and I just kind of like laughed and said, yep, you're right. And one of our listeners in our Facebook group, Amber, posted this comment and she said, you know, Megan said her kids never noticed, but my kid notices. And just the other day, he was looking for a drum that I'd given away 2 years ago, and he remembered it. And so I know, Megan, you have thoughts on this, but what we're talking about is when kids do have a hard time parting with their stuff, or when they do ask you like, hey, where'd that thing go that I never played with, but now all of a sudden I remember. And so I just want to say to Amber that I admitted it in the Facebook group that I actually do have kids who have done this too. And we just didn't have time to cover it in that episode. So we're taking this, we're continuing this discussion. But she's even said that she thinks her son might be a little bit of a hoarder. And Megan, I feel like you have some experience with this.
I do. Okay. So first of all, I never like to come off as glib about stuff like that. So I'm glad that Amber brought it up because I want to circle back to that. One of the things that Amber says, this is just an example that she gives, is that she gave the toddler drum set away, which, by the way, we all know we can't hang on to everything forever because our kid might eventually miss it. So I don't think that Amber's saying like, you know, was it wrong of me to give it away? But I just, in case you're having any guilt about the fact that you gave it away, like, we know that that has to happen sometimes. But then she said that she kind of matter-of-factly said, I gave it to my cousin for her baby. And that is when her little boy melted down. And then she also says that later on that that getting rid of things creates this anxiety reaction in her son. And it doesn't really matter when she tries to talk to him about paying it forward or giving it to people who could use it. It doesn't matter. It's anxiety. He has a really hard time with it. So one of the things that jumped out at me about that was that I think sometimes kids with like anxiety or these collecting tendencies need time to adjust to the fact that the thing isn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And so what might've felt to you like very matter of fact in a positive way, like, you know, I gave that to my cousin, she needed it and you don't, you know, may have come off like a little too abrupt.
Like shocking. Like
shocking, you know, and this might sound like awful advice, but in situations where because I definitely have a couple of kids who've had anxiety, and one in particular who's had a lot of anxiety around stuff. And the way I might've handled that was to kind of hem and haw, like, good question. Gosh, I haven't seen it in a while. I'll keep looking. Now, it could be seen as a lie because I do remember when I saw it. Well, it's true that I haven't seen it in a while. Mm-hmm. I won't actually keep looking. I have found that sometimes that's enough to kind of get over the hump of like, I want this thing right now, but they're probably not really going to want it again in a month mm-hmm. or in a week, especially if it's been gone for that long. So just a thought that maybe what your son was reacting to right then was just this, like, what do you mean you gave it away? Like, that right. wasn't yours to give away. So Clara does definitely have like hoarding tendencies. With us, it really didn't play out with toys, which is why I think with me, I was able to get away with the whole tossing toys behind her back. For her, it was stuff like scraps of paper and drawings and little notebooks that she would write in. And then I would have a million little notebooks and she would never want to get rid of anything. It really set in like around 3, 4, 5 when she was starting to do a lot of crafting and stuff. Mm-hmm. And she would say that it felt like throwing away a memory.
Aww.
And so like, of course that broke my heart, but we couldn't have piles and piles and piles of little scraps of paper. So I feel like this was a conversation we had to have like every day. We would say things like, okay, so, you know, I would have her clean her little crafting area and say, okay, well, if you really feel like you want to hold on to that, can you make 3 piles? Like the things that you know that you can get rid of, the things that you think you might be able to get rid of later, and the things that you know you'll never be able to get rid of. And then at least we have 3 piles. Now, the never going to get rid of later was the biggest pile mm-hmm. or ever is the mm-hmm. biggest pile. Like the maybe pile was moderate, and that I can get rid of this thing right now.
But you're still giving her like a framework for making those decisions, even if she was like at the baby step level.
Right. Yes. And eventually, like, some things would make, like, when her desk got so messy she couldn't use it, I would say, I think some more things need to move out of this pile, this middle pile, because now you don't have any room to do your work or like to draw or craft. And so she'd say, okay. And then she'd kind of go back and move a few things. She's 10 now and she talks kind of like, I don't know, like nostalgically and sort of like affectionately about herself as like when she was a little baby hoarder. And she's actually said that, like, I know sometimes it's hard for me not to hoard things and I'm working on it. I love the way Clara talks about herself, but she has become much more knowledgeable about, or self-aware, I guess is the right word. And also understands that there will always be more scraps of paper. There will always be more toys. But when she was 2 or 3, she couldn't understand that. And it took her a long, even when she was 4, 5, 6, 7, I think probably the height of that kind of anxiety for her was probably like 6 and 7.
First and second grade. I think that's actually about the age of Amber's son, if I remember right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's not super little. I think he's like 7. Okay. So yeah, I love everything that you just said. And first of all, I have had major, like, I have just been caught in the act of having given stuff away that my kids are. I've had all 3 kids in tears yelling at me that I gave away. And keep in mind, I'm not going around collecting their precious objects. I'm collecting in particular, there were a couple of Pokemon stuffed Pokemon, but from like a carnival, you know, where they're stuffed with like cardboard. they're not soft. They're like disposable stuffed animals, and they were huge. And we didn't have anywhere to store them, and they stopped playing with them. And I was hung out to dry for that one. But here's what I want to say, because I think Amber, one of her concerns about, should I sneak it out or should I have him face the music and do it himself? And by sneaking it out, am I sort of almost enabling these hoarding tendencies? Because now he's so worried that his stuff is going to disappear behind his back that he starts hoarding. I think those are really good questions to ask. I don't think it has to be either or. Like, I think about like anything that I want my kids to mature and grow about, it's like, it's a little bit of a give and take. On some days, like, we're all eating broccoli and that's for dinner. And if you don't like it, you can go to bed hungry. And there are some days where I just might sneak some hot dogs on the menu because I don't want to deal with the fight that night. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're navigating this in ebbs and flows. And so while I probably wouldn't advocate always sneaking everything out and never having him, like you did with Clara, that was really cool how like she had a process to go through. At the same time, I don't think there's anything wrong with sometimes doing a purge, making an executive decision as the household manager, and then later helping him with those feelings. So a lot of times I've seen it as, you know, I did get rid of that. Nobody had played with it in 6 months and we were making room in our house for new things. I say that to my kids a lot. You guys are really fortunate. Like, new toys and new things to do come into our house all the time. We've got 3 birthdays, we've got Christmases, and there isn't enough space. So sometimes I do make those decisions and then I can help the kid deal with the feelings that come up about that. But I probably wouldn't do one of those approaches all of the time. Does that make sense? Like, I'm not going to walk my kid through like a saying goodbye to this thing. Are you ready to part with it for every object that I donate? I'm just not, but I will do it sometimes. A couple other things I have done with larger objects that they were not quite ready to part with. I have actually paid my kids a few dollars for it's almost like I was buying the used item off of them and then I gave it away. And I've only done it twice and I wouldn't do it for everything. Just like I don't bribe for everything. I save the bribes for when I really need them. But the reason it worked is they were kid size armchairs, like the plush kind of armchairs.
They're big.
They take up a lot of space. Their little booties didn't fit in them anymore. And they were up on the shelf in the garage, but they had sentimental value for the kids. And I said, you know, they have sentimental value for me too. But what I think about is all the pictures we have of you guys sitting in those and all the movie nights where you dragged them out. And I said, if it's hard for you, I like to think about what could fill that space. Is there a new game or is there like something that we could use that space for? Cause our family's growing. And how's $5 to sweeten the deal? And I have done that. I've done it like maybe 2 or 3 times. And it's just helped them see that everything is a choice, right? I'm making a choice about how I use this space and what are the ramifications of holding on to this stuff. And I will say that ages 8 and 9 and up have gotten way easier. So Amber might be right at the, like, things might be about to be easier. But that I still think that as the mom, you kind of have some say in it. You can help him with the feelings, but you can't let him keep everything.
You can't
forever.
Hang on to the toy drum forever. Like, you just can't do it. Yeah, I agree. I like everything you said there. And I think that for me, like looking back, I think when it was starting to get the hardest for Clara was honestly when she had left, she wasn't playing with traditional toys quite as much. Like, there wasn't the influx. Like, when kids are really little, there's just new toys all the time because their developmental stages are changing and they're getting new stuff. And it's like stuff is coming at them. And then that started to slow down. Her interest became more tailored, more focused in certain kinds of toys. And I do remember like a year and a half to 2 year period where she had never been hugely into dolls, but she still had dolls.
Mm-hmm.
And they started ending up like in her closet and then just kind of staying there. And I was tempted to go in and just do a purge, but I thought, you know what? I'm just going to leave them in her closet because right now she's got some weirdness going on around getting rid of things and losing things. And I want to say there was like a 2 year period where I didn't take anything out of her closet.
Yeah.
Like, it was just all her toys like gravitated into the closet. Most never came back out. She stopped going and digging them out to play with them. Her play things became things like Littlest Pet Shop and like little, mm-hmm. you know, objects that she would do crafts with. She would just draw all over her Littlest Pet Shop and stuff like that. And so the toys just kind of languished. And then we moved when she was, let's see, just about to turn 9. We moved and we had to go through those closets, which had now been like just untouched. They mm-hmm. were like archaeological digs. And it was actually really fun at that age because we kind of went through everything and I was expecting a lot more pushback. And actually what happened is after a while, she kind of got bored and said, "Mom, you can finish this up." And like wandered away. And I was like, "Well, okay, so I know what I'm going to do." But I think that for her, like that, like not dealing with it at all for a little while gave her a breather. Like, because at any point she could have gone back in and gotten stuff out. And she just didn't. And I think by the time we finally unearthed it all, she just realized she wasn't going to. And I think the reason that worked is because it was during a time of her life when there wasn't a lot of other stuff coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the room wasn't getting overrun. It wasn't like stuff falling out of the closet. It was just these two huge toy bins in her closet that stayed full and exactly the same for, you know, probably from when she was 7 till she was 9.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I don't know. Not that that's a life strategy for people who, if that would drive you crazy, I just didn't look in there.
No, I think that's very much the phase. I think I want to be clear that going around and sneaking things into black plastic bags was, first of all, kind of a throwaway comment. But second of all, something I did much more often when I knew 100% that kids were not going to notice, or if they noticed that I was at a very defensible position on it. The things like the parting with like the calico critters that they really did play with for a long time, or those armchairs, they required a conversation. And they, like you said, sometimes they require waiting a year. Reed has some stuff in his closet right now that he is never going to play with again. And I have floated the idea and I've said, you know what? It's not taking up space. It's not getting in the way right now. So we'll just wait till you're ready. And he will be someday.
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
Whew, all right.
That was a big one.
Move on.
Okay.
I can read this one.
Sure.
Okay. So this question comes from Megan, but she spells it differently than me. It's M-E-G-H-A-N-N. I don't think I've ever seen it with two N's. So welcome to the not typically spelled Megan Club, Megan. I am a mom of 10-year-old boy-girl twins and a 7-year-old little guy. One topic I'd love to hear more about is why kids come home from school and melt down and how to handle the stressful part of the day. This also happens often in our family when kids come home and rejoin the family after a visit with grandparents. My understanding is the kids hold it together all day at school by following the rules, listening, keeping hands to themselves, and then they come home to a safe place where parents will love them through it. They let go. So Sarah, do you want to jump on this? I have a feeling you'll have a lot of good things to say.
I picked this one. Actually, Megan sent this in quite a while ago and it was just one that we didn't get to. And I found it today and I was like, well, this is back. We are in back to school central this time of year.
Right.
And so while it's so familiar to you and me to hear what she's saying, and in fact, this is one of those questions where she's kind of answered her own question, which is, you know, they come home and they let loose because they can at home. But for some of you out there, this might be new territory, in particular the new kinders. So I thought it would be good to talk about. I mean, I do think the reason it happens is because the expectations in a traditional school environment are a lot on all kids, in particularly wiggly kids, or kids who, you know, have trouble sitting still or keeping their hands to themselves. And more is expected of kids earlier and earlier nowadays. Mm-hmm. So, but even older kids in the back to school season, especially, it's a think about if you changed, like Megan, you were a freelancer and then all of a sudden you went to work in an office every day, your entire system, your brain, your emotional life, like everything has to get used to that pretty radical shift in schedule and expectations. And so I think sometimes we downplay the start of school or the transition to a new year. For even for older kids, it's just, it's not a bad thing. It's just a big change. And so I do think they come home and sometimes act like not themselves or not how you would prefer that they act. So, gosh, I guess knowing what to expect and knowing that it's normal is a huge piece of it for me. I would say I am stricter about certain things and more relaxed about certain things during the after school hour. When we did our episode a couple weeks ago, I talked about how I'm really strict about the after school put away your backpack routine, because I know it's not a time to be flexible. Like, it's a time when they need to know what to expect. But then I think I'm a little more lenient about things like, you know, like saying please for their snack and like being a little grumpy as they sit there. And like, I think I'm a little more empathetic about some of the moods that come home, short of, you know, abusing your family members, which you cannot do. So I don't know. I think it's just, yes, it's normal is my big one here. How about you?
Yeah. So I was nodding through all of that. I think the note that I made is it's okay to have feelings. It's not okay to use those feelings on someone else. And we all know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Like, it's okay. You can feel whatever you want to feel. It's not okay to hurt somebody, yell in my face, like those kinds of things. And that's kind of where I always draw the line. I love the after school routines. One thing that I've tried to pay attention to is do they need like immediate downtime once that routine is done? Is it like, can we stop and put a pin in our afternoon and everyone can retreat to their corners or snuggle quietly or whatever it is that they maybe need, like no expectations. They've had so many expectations on them throughout the day that sometimes it's nice for them to just be able to do whatever they want. And that can be really hard to pull off the way kids' lives are set up these days. But that's always been very helpful for us, is just to have some quiet time. And I feel like I say this a lot for a variety of different scenarios and reasons, but like sometimes the thing you did last year isn't going to work this year for some reason, or sometimes and I'm not talking about things like come in, hang up your backpack, like those after school routines, but sometimes literally the time you serve dinner needs to be moved back or up by a half hour. Sometimes you need to change the way you feel about snacking. Like maybe you haven't been keen on the kids having an after school snack right away because you do dinner early. So just because something worked, I guess, in the past, or you in all your best intended, well-laid plans, you're going to serve dinner at X time of night, or a snack is going to be at this time, or homework is going to happen at that time. Like, it might just not play out that way. So if we've talked about this before, like those first few weeks, just being almost like the newborn period or just paying attention to what's happening. And that's where I love to have things. I love to plan. I mean, I know that this is usually you're the planner, but I like to have all these fantasy plans that I make. And weeks in advance, I will have how I think my evenings are going to run all written out. But I kind of know I'm writing it down just to break it. Like, I know that I'm making a rule, and I'm going to find a weak link in someplace in that outline or that schedule. There's a weak link that I have not yet discovered. And it might be different than last year because my kids are all different ages, or maybe something else in the circumstances have changed, or they're getting home a little later, or they're leaving a little earlier, whatever it is, something's different. And I think that sometimes is just worth looking at. The way that you do things may need to shift. And sometimes it's a small shift.
Yeah.
Can make a big difference.
Yeah. I really like that. I have three concrete things to add, and they're seemingly unrelated. One is, do not underestimate the power of hydration when kids are, they're often hungry after school, but if you live in a place where the start of school is hot, thirsty kids are angry kids. And that goes all the way back down to toddlers. I think it was we were so conditioned in Arizona to really understand hydration, but kids often will not recognize when they're thirsty. And as we all know, like when you're dehydrated, it's like kind of too late. Like if you're thirsty, you're already kind of behind. So if you have grumpy kids after school, make sure they are getting hydrated because they might not have been drinking water all day. Number two, just an observation that my kids assume the most non-traditional poses in the after school hours. Like I got a video the other day of Violet just upside down, like upside down with her head between a couch. Like I just try and remember that they have been so upright and so sort of physically, this makes it sound like school is a horrible place, but like, you know, you are told what to do with your body almost 100% of the day. And so just be, let that be okay. Like my tween is now the size of an adult. And sometimes I'll look over and she's just like sprawled in kind of the most like unattractive, like awkward position on 10 different pillows. And I want to be like, gosh, can you like sit normal and read your book normally? But I don't say that because I feel like they need physically to just, it's like a coil that needs to
need to take up space.
Yes, exactly.
Or like Owen, his habit of crawling into like a hidey hole.
Yes.
That's always been his thing, burrowing in a blanket, like a little burrito. And I think that's because he's kind of introverted and school is like one raw exposed nerve. Like you're exposed to so many people you have to deal with all day and so much stimulation. He just wants to come home and cocoon himself. So
I love that. My little brother used to, my only brother, I made it sound like I have a whole bunch. My brother used to like crawl around on the floor, pushing his head into the carpet because it felt good. Like the sensory experience. So I'm just picturing all of these really funny things that kids do, hanging upside down, hanging off a chair backwards, tolerate it.
Older kids than you would think.
Older than you think. Yes, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. So tolerate it to the extent that you can, because it's probably serving some primal need that we don't even understand. And then my third thing has more to do with what Megan mentioned about sort of bottling up their emotional experiences during the day and then letting loose when it's safe at home. And I think kids do this differently. Some of them might just pick a fight with their sibling, but some might not say anything and it's going to come out in other ways. And I would say for those kids, just make sure there's some space in the evening routine somewhere where if they do want to talk, like you're doing dishes together or you're hanging out at bedtime, that there's a safe place for those school related experiences to come to light. It's probably not going to be at the counter having a snack. How was your day, honey? Well, great. Right. You know, this kid hurt my feelings. It doesn't play out that way. So there needs to be space somewhere. It doesn't have to be after school, but if there can be some safe place at some time in the evening, I think that's helpful for older kids.
I was just having this mental image, Sarah, of a couple episodes ago, I think it was when you talked about, tell me more about that, the five word. And I was just picturing a kid having a screaming tantrum and you saying, tell me more about that. Tell me more about that. So maybe the time to use tell me more about that is when things are in a calmer, quieter place.
Yes. And when they're volunteering information, when they're not volunteering information. Yeah. The strategy is different.
You're screaming at me. Tell me more about that.
Tell me more about that. Oh my gosh. That's so funny.
We are welcoming back Ritual as a sponsor today. Megan, we both try to make healthy choices, but you know, sometimes it's tricky to sort through fact and fiction when it comes to supplements and vitamins to figure out just what they're doing for us. That's why I'm glad Ritual keeps studying their products and sharing the results, especially as it relates to women, since women are the focus of all Ritual's products, including the Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin.
And the results are super reassuring. Just as an example, Ritual conducted a university-led clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin, and it was shown to increase vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin is made with high-quality and traceable key nutrients in clean, bioavailable forms with 9 key nutrients in 2 capsules per day. Plus, they are leading the industry when it comes to sustainability. They use lower carbon packaging and prioritize sustainably sourced ingredients. That kind of thoughtfulness really matters to me.
No more shady business. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/themomhour. Start Ritual or add the Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/themomhour for 25% off.
Sarah, we're welcoming our sponsor, Element. That's spelled L-M-N-T, a zero-sugar electrolyte drink that leans on current science about what our bodies really need in order to deliver the most effective hydration possible. You know, Sarah, Eric is really into keeping up with health research, and he's been insisting to me for years that we actually need more salt to stay hydrated. Turns out Element agrees because they've developed their product based on a growing body of research that shows that for optimal health outcomes, we actually need to be taking in sodium levels at 2 to 3 times government recommendations. That's a big difference.
Yeah, it really is, Megan. And, you know, electrolyte deficiency or imbalances can cause headaches, cramps, fatigue, brain fog, and weakness. I know I can feel really rotten when I'm dehydrated. And also, I don't love the taste of plain water, so I'm not that great about drinking it. Element makes a huge difference in how much I'm enjoying my hydration and in how I feel, and it's super easy to fit it into my daily routine. My favorite flavor of Element is the grapefruit, but if that's not for you, we're going to get you set up with a variety pack so you can find your favorite Element flavor. Plus, Element has a no questions asked refund policy. You don't even have to send the product back to get your refund.
Yeah, you can receive a free Element sample pack containing one packet of eight flavors. So you'll get eight total packets free with any order when you purchase through our custom URL. That's drinkelement.com/momhour, DRINKLMNT/momhour. This offer is available exclusively through our partnership, and it's available for both new and returning customers. To get that offer, again, go to drinkelement.com/momhour.
Okay, so we're down to the final two questions. It feels like we've had a countdown now. There are only two remaining, and then you have to wait a quarter before we do this again. But this question comes from Victoria via email. Victoria says, "Hi, Megan and Sarah. I have four-month-old twins, and listening to your show keeps me sane and makes me laugh. We love that. Thank you for what you do. I'm currently jumping into nap training and would love if you could talk about how you ladies have handled naps over the years." I think we need to point out that neither one of us had twins. So probably anything we say could just be utter junk in your world, Victoria.
It could be. But what I really want is for our experienced twin moms out there, including Kelsey on our team. We have a team member who has 5-year-old twins. If you guys want to call in or write in your specific twin infant nap advice, I would love it. And I will find a way to get it to Victoria, because we're not going to talk about twin nap training. She just happens to have twins. And what I know of twin parenting is the stakes are that much higher for getting everybody on a good sleep routine for the sanity of everyone. So some of the tips are similar. Just the importance seems more with twins, because if you're ever going to get a break, you got to get a nap.
Well, it takes like twice as long and it's twice as important.
Right. Yeah. For your own,
deal.
Yeah. What I love is to see twin moms who've figured it out, cracked the code. And then I feel like it's like a superpower. Like they can put two awake 1-year-olds in the same room and they'll sleep all night. And I'm like, what? How do you do that? I wanted to talk about this because, you guys know I have a really bad memory for some things. Like I can't remember the plot of the book that I literally just finished, but I have weirdly a good memory for milestones and baby timelines. And because my sister's having her babies now, we've talked a lot about like, when did they go from two naps to one and how did I do that? So yeah. I'm going to give you my 3-minute, like how naps worked with my babies for the first like year and a half, 2 years. And Megan, you can just sit back because I'm 100% sure you did not do this. So for the first 6 months, I wouldn't say I tried much of anything. They mostly napped on me. I was either wearing them, or if they fell asleep in the car seat, then they could sleep anywhere, basically swing, car seat. My babies naturally were all catnappers, meaning if I tried to do the proper thing to lay them down for a proper nap, I never got more than 35, 40 minutes. And that was good. If anything, it was half that. And that became really frustrating early on. So I just took the approach of kind of letting their daytime schedule. What I paid attention to was how long they'd been awake in between naps. That always felt easier for me. Like I knew, a really little tiny infant can only be awake for like minutes and then maybe an hour and then it's an hour and a half. And that in between naps, that was kind of what I kept my eye on rather than a schedule. It was like, okay, this baby is no good after he's been awake for 2 hours. It's time for another reset. Somewhere around 6 months, I started to try to nap them in their crib, like at least once a day, and usually the morning nap. And it felt like finally around 6 months that there was some predictability around that. But really from 6 to 12 months, they were still on, they still had multiple naps because they were never long nappers. They weren't giving me 2 hours. So therefore it happened over and over throughout the day. I do remember 9-10 months being where we'd have two, like a morning nap, an afternoon nap. And then sometimes like that, I'm going to pop you in the ergo while I make dinner and hope that you give me like 20 minutes so that then we can get to a real bedtime. Cause I don't want to put you to bed at 5:30. That was always the thing was like, we're not going to make it till bedtime on the two naps you gave me. So let's go in the car. So I do remember a distinct phase of like, okay, we're down to two naps plus a, I don't know what you call it, like a little, like a bonus. And if we get that little,
like a cat nap.
Yeah. And if we yeah. get that cat nap, then it felt like bedtime could be at a, like a real bedtime. And then the night times were getting easier, blah, blah, blah. And then I remember very well going from two naps to one, because I felt like once my babies were on two naps a day, which really was like probably 9 or 10 months old, life was golden for a long time. It was predictable. Mm-hmm. It was, mine were always early risers. So their naps would be like maybe like 8:30 or 9, they'd go down again to like 10 or 10:30. And then again at like 1 to 2:30, and then they'd make it till bedtime. And that was my life for a long time. It felt like that was finally a stretch. And then going from two naps to one is kind of comically,
it's the pits.
It's kind of comically painful. It is the worst. And mine seemed to need longer to get there. I think they were like 15, 16 months, before they could do one nap. And I just remember, please stay awake. Like, please don't fall asleep in the car for 5 minutes at 10 a.m. because then all of a sudden that's your morning nap, and the right. whatever the afternoon one is now shot, or it's going to happen later. So I just remember that. And then I kept one napping kids until they were all like 3.5 to 4. They kept that, you know, 12:30, 1 o'clock nap. Whoa. Did I do all naps from 0 to age 3?
I think you did. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Your kids would have still been napping. Like, your older would have still been napping when the baby came, right? A little bit?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I never had three napping at once, because Allegra was almost 5 when Violet was born.
That's right.
I had 2 overlapping nappers twice. And I remember it took me a full year to line up where Allegra's afternoon nap matched up with Reed's second of 2 naps. But that took a year of 2 babies.
And then by the time you get there, it's like practically
right.
over.
Yes.
Did you put the baby down first or the slightly older baby?
I think.
You remember?
So when I had like a 3 and a 1 year old or a 2 and a 6 month old, I feel like I'd probably put the older one down first, but I don't remember. It might have depended on the season or who was most tired, like who really needed a nap.
The other thing I'm thinking about from like the whole, like when one starts to give up that afternoon or the morning nap, you know, when they go down to one nap, is like, how would that look with twins?
Yeah.
Because then you're just used to them doing the same thing. And then suddenly one has to do something completely different, but they're still the same age. Like that, I feel like that would be really challenging. So I'd be curious to hear from twin mamas about that.
Very difficult.
And it's funny. I was going to say, even though I didn't go through like the first year rigmarole that you were talking about, like I was not obviously as scientific about it, but my kids in their toddler, you know, in their second year still settled into basically exactly what you described, only they weren't early risers. So it was more like, an hour, it was like shifted forward 2 hours.
Right. So would their afternoon nap be at like 2, 2:30? Like something like that?
Yeah. I used to get a lot of writing done in the afternoons. I remember sitting and sometimes I would have like, because I'd have kids of multiple ages, sometimes I'd have one snuggled up next to me while the other one was sleeping in another room, and I would just write and write and write. And because it was like the only concentrated time I knew I could get, because the smaller of the two, whoever the two little ones at the time were, would nap twice, but the older would only nap once. So I had to make like the absolute most of those 2 hours, and man, I could be productive.
Yes.
When you know that's all you're going to get.
Yep.
You use it.
That was the stage of life I was in when you hired me. That was like,
that's right.
I was getting 2 jobs done in like a daily nap somehow. I also have a comment about, cause I know twin moms especially focus on, you know, getting babies on a schedule and often sleeping as long as possible at night so that you can get some rest. And I did do some like sleep training with my babies, but I always looked at naps differently, especially if we were focusing on nighttime sleep. So if I was doing some, you know, method or another to get my babies to sleep longer or to require me less at night, I often did not do that approach at all during the day. And I know there's probably different schools of thought on this, but my thought was I needed all the daytime flexibility, meaning like, let's just nap in the ergo, let's nap in the Mobi wrap, let's nap in the car, because both of us needed kind of a reset if we were working on some good sleep habits at night. So I think I was much more loosey goosey in that first 6 to 9 months about the daytime sleep, but that was where I, you know, was probably trying some method or another at night, and they looked very different. So I think if you're feeling pressure to do the same thing for daytime sleep as you do for nighttime, I don't think you really have to. I mean, maybe I'm sure there are schools of thought that would disagree with that, but it felt different. Just like when we've talked about potty training, daytime potty training and nighttime potty training are two very different things. I think daytime sleep and nighttime sleep are different.
And kids know. I mean, it's like it happens at a different time. The context is different. If the light is different, like they, even little ones can sense that these are two different kinds of sleep situations.
Yes. Agreed. Well, that was a trip down memory lane, and I'm very glad that my day is no longer determined by nap schedules anymore. Nap.
Although sometimes I do wish my kids would take naps even now. Like, can we all just take a nap? That sounds great to me.
All right. Okay, so we have come to our last question, and it's kind of a big one. It comes from Michelle, and she called it in not too long ago, so we will listen to that now.
Hi, Megan and Sarah. This is Michelle. I'm a longtime listener. I love your show and your insight. I have kind of a serious foreboding question, I guess. There was another mass shooting today, and I was wondering how you talk to your kids of various ages about these. I know there's obviously a very wide range of different parenting approaches and how much or how little you choose to share with your child. From my experience, I am a former first and second grade teacher, so I'm coming at it from the lens of what I've had to explain to my first graders about a lockdown drill. What is the purpose of a lockdown drill? Why are we hiding in the corner? Why do we have to be quiet? Things like that. But since you have such a range of ages between all 8 of your kids, I was curious how you approach this at the different ages. Any insight or direction on how to approach this topic is appreciated.
Okay, Michelle, thank you for the question. This is a biggie, and it's definitely something that's been on my mind lately. It's funny, like my oldest is almost 22, and Jacob was a toddler when Columbine happened, and then he was 4, and Isaac was 2 on 9/11. So I feel like I've been dealing with some big, horrible story in the news, like every 2 years, maybe a little more frequently since my kids were tiny. Mm-hmm. And so I've become like, in a way, it's become this thing that's just kind of constantly in the back of my head, but yet never gets easier. Like you would think with time, it would just be, I never quite know how to deal. Like a new one will happen and I'll think, man, I wish I would have gotten that together the last time so that this time I would know exactly what to say. But I just don't know that it's possible because A, all your children are different. If you have more than one, the way they react to news is different. The input they get from their friends is probably different. The way their school might talk about it is different. So I guess I'll just talk about what I do, knowing that like this isn't something that I think has been researched for many, many, many decades. And they can say this is the one absolute right way to talk to your kids about hard news. Like there's this the approach changes as our reality changes. And your reality might be different from mine. So I try to walk that line between like knowing that my kids are aware of what's going on in the world already, where I'm not trying to shelter them, but I want our home to feel like a safe place where we can feel at ease. Mm-hmm. And it might literally be the only place where they feel like that sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel like it's my job to inform them about all the nitty gritty of what happened or really even go into a lot of detail about it unless they're asking. I do ask them questions because I want to make sure they're not getting misinformation for through friends or whatever. Like, so I'll ask them questions, but I don't volunteer information that's not been asked for. And I don't know if that's the right or wrong approach, but I'm not like, I don't bring forward information that one of my kids didn't look at me and ask for unless maybe it's one of my adult children and it's more like, let's have a conversation about how the world is right now, which feels very different to me than when I'm talking to my 10-year-old.
I'm going to jump in there just because I agree and I have taken the same approach. So I guess I'm just validating. And the only time I can think of recently where it wasn't led by the kids' questions or what they had heard was when there was a tragedy involving a very local family. And it brought up some things that I realized I needed to talk to my oldest about. And I did do it preemptively, but that came to mind as the only time. And the reason was I knew that there was going to be quite a bit of local discussion and I wanted to make sure that the facts were represented. But when it comes to wider news stories, I have taken the same approach as you. And I didn't mean to cut you off there, but just like same.
Yeah. And I also think like we also had something happen. One of my kids' school's principal died a few years ago, and it was terribly tragic. And what happened? And there was a lot, like the official story was never really told. So there was a lot of gossip, and he was someone who was close to our family. And so I felt like they needed to know, because I also didn't want them speculating with their friends. It's a very personal thing and that kind of thing. But when it's, I guess the other thing I feel like about something like a school shooting or some kind of violent something that my kids don't have any control over is they're already doing everything they can to keep themselves safe. It's not like something like talking to them about not taking candy from strangers. Mm-hmm. They probably are doing lockdown drills in their school. Our school handles it pretty well, I think, but it's definitely the teachers understand how to make them safe in a situation like this, or as safe as possible in a situation like this. There's already like a structure around it. There's already a plan in place. And what can I add to that besides more fear if I keep bringing it up? Like, there's nothing I can tell them. It's just, I don't know. Like, it's kind of like, what, is there a reason for me to talk about this that they don't want to? And if there's not, then I don't.
Yeah.
And I don't, again, I don't know if that's the right approach or not.
I don't think either of us know. But I am reminded of our conversation last week where we talked about using the plainest language possible. If a kid does have a question, or if there's been a news event that's so widely talked about that it needs to be spoken. I have said things like, a lot of people died in a really tragic event today, and I'm feeling really sad about it, and kept it that simple. I think we mentioned this last week, but the desire, or what we bring to a situation, our fears, every other time this has happened and what we feel triggered by is different than our kids. So I think if we can simplify to the most plain spoken facts, even if those are hard and sad, then I think it gives kids room to ask the questions that they really have. And the questions they have might be different than what you thought they were going to ask questions about. I did an interview a million years ago. I think it was like our second ever Voices, with a woman named Jennifer Fried, about talking to kids about tragic events. And the couple of things that still stick with me, one was that she talked a lot about your own self-care. She talked a lot about managing our own intake of this kind of news. And I was almost surprised. I thought she was going to tell me how to talk to kids about it. But she was very clear that the way and the quantity in which we take in news media is really something to think about if we're going to be present and available to our kids. So I will just say that because that's what she said. But if you are feeling like you're, reading so much that it's causing you anxiety, that you can feel like you can take a step back from that. And it doesn't mean that you're checking out or that you're, don't care, but you don't have to consume the 24-hour news media cycle. And I would say, at least when my kids were really little, I did not want them exposed to that at all. I never had the radio. It bummed me out because sometimes I wanted to be listening to NPR or have CNN on or something. And I just didn't, after they were like, honestly, like 2 years old, because they were listening to everything. And so I sheltered them in that way, but then I also don't want to shelter them when it comes to the real questions and the real things that happen. But that constant media commentary in the background is, I think it's unhealthy for most of us, let alone for our kids. So
you're getting those, what is the stress hormone?
Cortisol.
Yeah. You're just getting constant cortisol spikes.
Yeah.
Because all you're hearing is, first of all, bad news, people arguing about bad news.
Yeah.
Even just like the sounds of the voices on the TV can stress me out, the way they talk about the bad news. So yes, I am very much the same. I choose how and where I'm going to consume it. And it's in like, it's like need to know basis.
Yeah.
In and out.
Yeah. And the other thing she said was what you started this whole conversation with. And I remember being surprised that she really said that for the most part, we can follow our kids' lead and answer their questions. It's not, I'm sure there's exceptions to this, so don't take this as an absolute, but in most cases, it's not our job to sit everybody down and say, okay, children, today in El Paso, this happened. And I actually thought I thought that maybe that was the right thing to do, depending on the age of the kid. And she really advocated for letting the kids you know, saying, what did you hear? What questions do you have? How are you feeling? And then I remember we also talked about whenever possible, if kids are feeling really upset or traumatized by something, taking any action that you can take, whether it's writing a letter together, drawing a picture for someone who's sad, getting the kids and yourself to put that into something actionable, is so helpful rather than just internalize the, you know, the horror. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, I like that. Well, doing something always makes you feel better.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
One final thought on this lockdown drill thing, because Michelle comes at this from her perspective as a teacher. And we've had a lot of listeners, maybe not a lot, more than once, we've had listeners write to us with questions about, oh my gosh, my kid's in school now and they're doing lockdown drills. And this is so heartbreaking. And this, I can't believe this is a thing. And I agree that it's just really terrible to think about first graders practicing these things. But I will also say that I have been in classrooms and I've been part of elementary school drills, and the drill itself does not feel as terrifying as what we know it's about. Does that make sense? Yeah. Like, I don't want to diminish what we're talking about. Of course, that's terrifying. That's a whole separate issue. But I've been a part of some of these drills, and the teachers are very professional. They're very calm. The schools have their protocol. And for the most part, kids were not, I think what I worried about is kids being traumatized, like, you know, but the kids, they're not given a lot of information about the scenario that they're practicing for. And I look back and I think of earthquake drills that we did.
And we did fire drills.
Yeah.
And before us, they used to do nuclear bomb drills. You know, I remember my old high school or elementary school still had the signs on the walls for like fallout shelter in the basement. And I remember thinking like, wow, that must've been so scary, and asking my mom, and she's like, well, no, they just, I mean, all schools had it. It was kind of like, yeah. And I'm not saying we should ever get to a point where we're blasé about any of this stuff either.
I don't think either you or I are blasé about the fact that we have to have these is upsetting. But the experience for the kids that I have seen has not been a one of panic for the most part. It's another drill.
And when I've asked my kids about it, like, oh, I heard you had a lockdown drill, how'd that go? They're kind of like, meh. I mean, it doesn't seem to stress them out. And I think that was my point of saying, you know, what more can I add to that at home? They've already know what happened. They've already had the drill. The school's already doing everything they can to keep them safe. Like, there's nothing more that me perseverating on this topic is going to bring to it.
Yeah.
Besides anxiety for both of us.
So. I agree. And this was like, we just answered this for ages like 4 to 21. So I feel like it should go without saying that each age comes with slightly more information and probably more interesting and thoughtful questions from the kids. And you're never done. You never have one conversation about mass violence and then you're done. You're having it over and over again.
Over and over.
Forever. Okay.
Well,
no, but in all seriousness, Michelle, I'm really glad that you sent in that question. And this show is meant to be really fun and light and encouraging, but the world is not always fun and light and encouraging. So
yes,
we try to take these sensitively and thoughtfully. And so thank you, Michelle. And thank you, everybody who sent in questions today.
Yeah, this was a fun one.
Okay, so before we leave you guys today, we are back with our Cue It Up segment after kind of taking the summer off. And this segment is where we like to leave you with a recommendation for something else to listen to when our show wraps up. And sometimes it's one of our own episodes from the archives. And other times, like today, it's a podcast that's put out by a friend or colleague of ours in the industry. And so that's what we're doing today.
Yeah, today we want to give a shout out to a podcast called Real Women, Real Stories from OneToughBee.com. Is literally One Tough Bee. I'm not being coy. It's hosted by our friend Kristen Chase, whose voice you would recognize if you're a fan of Spawned with Kristen and Liz. But on this show, Kristen tells the stories of real women inspiring others through tough situations with amazing perseverance.
Yeah, so stick around and you'll hear a little preview of season 2 of Real Women, Real Stories, which launches in early September of this year, 2019. Again, it's Real Women, Real Stories. And if you're looking for some encouragement and inspiration today, you should definitely check it out wherever you get your podcasts. And Megan, that's it for our show today. We'll be back with you guys soon.
Talk to you then.
Hi, listeners. This is Kristen Chase, the host of Real Women, Real Stories. For this week's season 2 teaser, you'll hear from Virgie, a body positivity author and speaker who decided she had enough of fat shaming.
I was learning that there was something very wrong with my body because I was fat. And because I was a girl who was fat, I was also violating a beauty standard. So I at about 5 years old, which is, you know, unfortunately, the average age that children learn this in the United States, I was introduced to this concept. Something's wrong with you. Your body is ugly. Your body is doing something wrong. And you need to do anything in your power to fix it. And for as long as it takes you to fix it, that is, become a thin person, you are going to be emotionally tortured incessantly. At the end of the day, for a lot of people, when they come and tell me that they want to lose weight, they often mean, I want to be happy, I want to be respected, I want to be able to find clothes I like, I want to be treated seriously as a romantic partner. And at the end of the day, you don't need to be thin to get those things.
Want more? Be sure you're a subscriber and then tune in September 5th when we launch our next season of Real Women, Real Stories. We're so glad you're here.
The Mom Hour is brought to you by partners like Chatbooks. Chatbooks makes it beyond easy to create beautiful photo books by importing your digital photos from anywhere. Instagram, Facebook, Google Photos, or directly from your phone. The books come in a variety of sizes with beautiful cover options and binding styles to choose from, and they start at just $15. Plus, we have a great deal just for our listeners. Use code THEMOMHOUR20 to save 20% off your purchase. Just download the Chatbooks app and use code THEMOMHOUR20 to save 20%.
Sarah, I have been having just the best time making my new podcast, The Teas Made. I launched back in November, and so far I've covered topics like staying warm on cold winter walks, nurturing creativity, how to be a great host, and even Nordic secrets to loving winter.
Well, you know I am fan number one of The Teas Made. It's got such a cozy vibe, and it seems like you've really hit your stride in covering topics like wellness, self-care, comforting rituals and routines, and home and family life.
Just look for The Teas Made with Megan Francis wherever you get your podcasts, or head to theteasmade.com to find all the episodes.